and the chain whipped across his face. Gwenda cried out as if she herself had been hurt. The onlookers gasped. Sam staggered, and the iron fell to the ground. There was a moment of suspense. Blood came from Sam's ear and nose. Gwenda took a step towards him, stretching out her arms. Then Sam recovered from the shock. He turned back to Jono and swung his heavy wooden spade in one graceful movement. Jono had not quite recovered his balance after the effort of his throw, and he was unable to dodge. The edge of the spade caught him on the side of the head. Sam was strong, and the sound of wood on bone rang out across the village street. Jono was still reeling when Sam hit him again. Now the spade came straight down from above. Swung by both Sam's arms, it landed on top of Jono's head, edge first, with tremendous force. This time the impact did not ring out, but sounded more like a dull thud, and Gwenda feared Jono's skull had cracked. As Jono slumped to his knees, Sam hit him a third time, another full-force blow with the oak blade, this one across his victim's forehead. An iron sword could hardly have been more damaging, Gwenda thought despairingly. She stepped forward to restrain Sam, but the village men had had the same idea a moment earlier and got there before her. They pulled Sam away, two of them holding each arm. Jono lay on the ground, his head in a pool of blood. Gwenda was sickened by the sight and could not help thinking of the boy's father, Nate, and how grieved he would be by his son's injuries. Jono's mother had died of the plague, so at least she was in a place where grief could not afflict her. Gwenda could see that Sam was not badly hurt. He was bleeding, but still struggling with his captors, trying to get free so that he could attack again. Gwenda bent over Jono. His eyes were closed, and he was not moving. She put a hand on his heart and felt nothing. She tried for a pulse, the way Caris had shown her, but there was none. Jono did not seem to be breathing. The implications of what had happened dawned on her, and she began to weep. Jono was dead, and Sam was a murderer. Chapter 82. On Easter Sunday that year, 1361, Caris and Merthyn had been married 10 years. Standing in the cathedral, watching the Easter procession, Caris recalled their wedding. Because they had been lovers off and on for so long, they had seen the ceremony as no more than confirmation of a long-established fact, and they had foolishly envisaged a small, quiet event, a low-key service in St. Mark's Church and a modest dinner for a few people afterwards at the Bell. But Father Geoffroy had informed them the day before that by his calculation at least 2,000 people were planning to attend the wedding, and they had been forced to move it to the cathedral. Then it turned out that, without their knowledge, Madge Webber had organized a banquet in the Guildhall for leading citizens and a picnic in Lover's Field for everyone else in Kingsbridge. So, in the end, it had been the wedding of the year. Caris smiled at the recollection. She had worn a new robe of Kingsbridge scarlet, a colour the bishop probably thought appropriate for such a woman. Merthyn had dressed in a richly patterned Italian coat, chestnut brown with gold threads, and had seemed to glow with happiness. They both had realized, belatedly, that their drawn-out love affair, which they had imagined to be a private drama, had been entertaining the citizens of Kingsbridge for years, and everyone wanted to celebrate its happy ending. Her pleasant memories evaporated as her old enemy Philemon mounted the pulpit. In the decade since the wedding he had grown quite fat. His monkish tonsure and shaved face revealed a ring of blubber around his neck, and the priestly robes billowed like a tent. He preached a sermon against dissection. "Dead bodies belonged to God," he said. "Christians were instructed to bury them in a carefully specified ritual, the saved in consecrated ground, the unforgiven elsewhere. To do anything else with corpses was against God's will. To cut them up was sacrilege," he said with uncharacteristic passion. There was even a tremor in his voice as he asked the congregation to imagine the horrible scene of a body being opened its parts separated and sliced and pored over by so-called medical researchers. True Christians knew there was no excuse for these ghoulish men and women. The phrase men and women was not often heard from Philemon's mouth, Caris thought, and could not be without significance. She glanced at her husband, standing next to her in the nave, and he raised his eyebrows in an expression of concern. The prohibition against examining corpses was standard dogma, propounded by the church since before Caris could remember, but it had been relaxed since the plague. Progressive younger clergymen were vividly aware of how badly the church had failed its people then, and they were keen to change the way medicine was taught and practiced by priests. However, conservative senior clergy clung to the old ways and blocked any change in policy. The upshot was that dissection was banned in principle and tolerated in practice. Caris had been performing dissections at her new hospital from the start. She never talked about it outside the building. There was no point in upsetting the superstitious, but she did it every chance she got. In recent years, she had usually been joined by one or two younger monk physicians. Many trained doctors never saw inside the body except when treating very bad wounds. Traditionally, the only carcasses they were allowed to open were those of pigs, thought to be the animals most like humans in their anatomy. Caris was puzzled as well as worried by Philemon's attack. He had always hated her, she knew, though she had never been sure why. But since the great standoff in the snowfall of 1351, he had ignored her. As if in compensation for his loss of power over the town, he had furnished his palace with precious objects, tapestries, carpets, silver tableware, stained glass windows, illuminated manuscripts. He had become ever more grand, demanding elaborate deference from his monks and novices, wearing gorgeous robes for services, and travelling, when he had to go to other towns, in a charrette that was furnished like a duchess's boudoir. There were several important visiting clergymen in the choir for the service, Bishop Henri of Shiring, Archbishop Piers of Monmouth, and Archdeacon Reginald of York, and presumably Philemon was hoping to impress them with this outburst of doctrinal conservatism. But to what end? Was he looking for promotion? The archbishop was ill. He had been carried into the church. But surely Philemon could not aspire to that post. It was something of a miracle that the son of Joby from Wigley should have risen to be prior of Kingsbridge. Besides, elevation from prior to archbishop would be an unusually big jump, a bit like going from knight to duke without becoming a baron or an earl in between. Only a special favourite could hope for such a rapid rise. However, there was no limit to Philemon's ambition. It was not that he felt himself to be superbly well qualified, Caris thought. That had been Godwin's attitude, arrogant self-confidence. Godwin had assumed that God made him prior because he was the cleverest man in town. Philemon was at the opposite extreme. In his heart, he believed he was a nobody. His life was a campaign to convince himself that he was not completely worthless. He was so sensitive to rejection that he could not bear to consider himself undeserving of any post, no matter how lofty. She thought of speaking to Bishop Henri after the service. She might remind him of the 10-year-old agreement that the prior of Kingsbridge had no jurisdiction over the hospital of St. Elizabeth on Leper Island, which came under the bishop's direct control, so that any attack on the hospital was an attack on the rights and privileges of Henri himself. But, on further reflection, she realized that such a protest would confirm to the bishop that she was conducting dissections, and turn what might now be only a vague suspicion, easily ignored, into a known fact that must be dealt with. So she decided to remain silent. Standing beside her were Merthyn's two nephews, the sons of Earl Ralph. Jerry, age 13, and Rowley, 10. Both boys were enrolled in the monks' school. They lived in the priory, but spent much of their free time with Merthyn and Caris at their house on the island. Merthyn had his hand resting casually on the shoulder of Rowley. Only three people in the world knew that Rowley was not his nephew, but his son, They were Merthyn himself, Caris, and the boy's mother, Philippa. Merthyn tried not to show special favour to Rowley, but found it hard to disguise his true feelings, and was especially delighted when Rowley learned something new Ward did well at school. Caris often thought about the child she had conceived with Merthyn and then aborted. She always imagined it to have been a girl. She would be a woman now, Caris mused, 23 years old, probably married with children of her own. The thought was like the ache of an old wound, painful but too familiar to be distressing. When the service was over, they all left together. The boys were invited to Sunday dinner, as always. Outside the cathedral, Merthyn turned to look back at the tower that now soared high over the middle of the church. As he examined his almost finished work, frowning at some detail visible only to him, Caris studied him fondly. She had known him since he was 11 years old, and had loved him almost as long. He was 45 now. His red hair was receding from his brow, and stood up around his head like a curly halo. He had carried his left arm stiffly ever since a small carved stone corbel, dropped from the scaffolding by a careless mason, had fallen on his shoulder. But he still had the expression of boyish eagerness that had drawn the 10-year-old Caris to him on All Hallows' Day a third of a century ago. She turned to share his view. The tower appeared to stand neatly on the four sides of the crossing, and to be exactly 2 bays square, even though, in fact, its weight was held up by massive buttresses built into the exterior corners of the transepts, which themselves rested on new foundations, separate from the old original ones. The tower looked light and airy, with slender columns and multiple window openings, through which you could see blue sky in fine weather. Above the square top of the tower, a web of scaffolding was rising for the final stage, the spire. When Caris brought her gaze back down to ground level, she saw her sister approaching. Alice was only a year older at 45, but Caris felt she was from another generation. Her husband, Elfric, had died in the plague, but she had not remarried, becoming frumpy, as if she thought that was how a widow should be. Caris had quarrelled with Alice many years ago over Elfric's treatment of Merthyn. The passage of time had blunted the edge of their mutual hostility, but there was still a resentful tilt to Alice's head when she said hello. With her was Griselda, her stepdaughter, though only a year younger than Alice. Griselda's son, known as Merthyn Bastard, stood beside her, towering over her, a big man with superficial charm, just like his father, the long-gone Thurston, and about as different from Merthyn Bridger as could be. Also with her was her 16-year-old daughter, Petronilla. Griselda's husband, Harold Mason, had taken over the business after Elfric died. He was not much of a builder, according to Merthyn, but he was doing all right, although he did not have the monopoly of priory repairs and extensions that had made Elfric rich. He stood next to Merthyn now and said, "People think you're going to build the spire with no formwork." Caris understood. Formwork, or centering, was the wooden frame that held the masonry in place until the mortar dried. Merthyn said, "Not much room for formwork inside that narrow spire, and how would it be supported?" His tone was polite, but Caris could tell from his briskness that he did not like Harold. "I could believe it if the spire was going to be round." Caris understood this, too. A round spire could be built by placing one circle of stones on top of another, each a little narrower than the last. No formwork was needed, because the circle was self-supporting. The stones could not fall inwards because they pressed on one another. The same was not true of any shape with corners. "You've seen the drawings," Merthyn said. "It's an octagon." The corner turrets on the top of the square tower faced diagonally outwards, easing the eye as it progressed upwards to the different shape of the narrower spire. Merthyn had copied this feature from Chartres, but it made sense only if the tower was octagonal. Harold said, "But how can you build an octagonal tower without formwork?" "Wait and see," said Merthyn, and he moved away. As they walked down the main street, Caris said, "Why won't you tell people how you're going to do it. So that they can't fire me, he replied. When I was building the bridge, as soon as I'd done the hard part, they got rid of me and hired someone cheaper. I remember. They can't do that now, because no one else can build the spire. You were a youngster then. Now you're alderman. No one would dare sack you. Perhaps not. But it's nice to feel they can't. At the bottom of the main street, where the old bridge had stood, there was a disreputable tavern called the White Horse. Caris saw Merthin's 16-year-old daughter, Lola, leaning on the wall outside, with a group of older friends. Lola was an attractive girl, with olive skin and lustrous dark hair, a generous mouth and sultry brown eyes. The group was crowded around a dice game, and they were all drinking ale from large tankards. Caris was sorry, though not surprised, to see her stepdaughter carousing on the street at midday. Merthin was angry. He went up to Lola and took her arm. "You'd better come home for your dinner," he said in a tight voice. She tossed her head, shaking her thick hair in a gesture that was undoubtedly meant for the eyes of someone other than her father. "I don't want to go home. I'm happy here," she said. "I didn't ask what you wanted," Merthin replied, and he jerked her away from the others. A good-looking boy of about 20 detached himself from the crowd. He had curly hair and a mocking smile, and he was picking his teeth with a twig. Caris recognized Jake Riley, a lad of no particular profession, who nevertheless always seemed to have money to spend. He sauntered over. "What's going on?" he said. He spoke with the twig sticking out of his mouth like an insult. "None of your damn business," Merthin said. Jake stood in his way. "The girl doesn't want to leave." "You'd better get out of my way, son, unless you want to spend the rest of the day in the town's stocks." Caris froze with anxiety. Merthin was in the right. He was entitled to discipline Lola, who was still 5 years short of adulthood. But Jake was the kind of boy who might punch him anyway and take the consequences. However, Caris did not intervene, knowing it might make Merthin angry with her instead of with Jake. Jake said, "I suppose you're her father. You know perfectly well who I am, and you can call me Alderman and speak respectfully to me, or suffer the consequences." Jake stared insolently at Merthin a moment longer, then turned aside, casually saying, "Yes, all right." Caris was relieved that the confrontation had not turned into fisticuffs. Merthin never got into fights, but Lola was capable of driving him to distraction. They walked on towards the bridge. Lola shook herself free of her father's grasp and walked on ahead, arms folded under her breasts, head down, frowning and muttering to herself in a full-dress sulk. This was not the first time Lola had been seen in bad company. Merthin was horrified and enraged that his little girl should be so determined to seek out such people. "Why does she do it?" he said to Caris as they followed Lola across the bridge to Leper Island. "God knows." Caris had observed that this kind of behavior was more common in youngsters who had suffered the loss of a parent. After Sylvia died, Lola had been mothered by Betty Bell, Lady Philippa, Merthin's housekeeper Em, and of course Caris herself. Perhaps she was confused about who she should obey. But Caris did not voice this thought, as it might seem to suggest that Merthin had somehow failed as a parent. "I had terrible fights with Aunt Petronilla when I was that age." "What about?" "Similar things. She didn't like me spending time with Matty Wise." "That's completely different. You didn't go to low taverns with rogues." "Petronilla thought Matty was bad company." "It's not the same." "I suppose not." "You learned a lot from Matty." Lola was undoubtedly learning a lot from handsome Jake Riley, but Caris kept that inflammatory thought to herself. Merthin was furious enough already. The island was entirely built up now, and an integral part of the city. It even had its own parish church. Where once they had wandered across waste ground, they now followed a footpath that ran straight between houses and turned sharp corners. The rabbits had long gone. The hospital occupied most of the western end. Although Caris went there every day, she still felt a glow of pride when she looked at the clean grey stonework, the large windows in regular rows, and the chimneys lined up like soldiers. They passed through a gate into Merthyn's grounds. The orchard was mature, and blossoms covered the apple trees like snow. As always, they went in through the kitchen door. The house had a grand entrance on the riverside which no one ever used. Even a brilliant architect can make a mistake, Caris thought with amusement, but once again she decided to give the thought no voice today. Lola stamped upstairs to her room. From the front room, a woman called, "Hello, everyone!" The two boys rushed into the parlour with glad cries. It was their mother, Philippa. Merthyn and Caris greeted her warmly. Caris and Philippa had become sisters-in-law when Caris married Merthyn, but their past rivalry had continued to make Caris feel awkward in Philippa's presence for some years. Eventually, the boys had brought them together. When first Jerry, then Rowley, enrolled at the Priory School, it was natural for Merthyn to look after his nephews, and then it became normal for Philippa to call at Merthyn's house whenever she was in Kingsbridge. At first, Caris had felt jealous of Philippa for having attracted Merthyn sexually. Merthyn had never tried to pretend that his love for Philippa had been merely superficial. He clearly still cared about her. But Philippa nowadays cut a sad figure. She was 54 and looked older, her hair grey and her face lined with disappointment. She lived now for her children. She was a frequent guest of her daughter, Odila, the Countess of Monmouth, and when she was not there, she often visited Kingsbridge Priory to be close to her sons. She managed to spend very little time at Earl's Castle with her husband, Ralph. "I've got to take the boys to Shiring," she said, explaining her presence here. "Ralph wants them to attend the county court with him. He says it's a necessary part of their education." "He's right," Caris said. "Jerry would be the Earl if he lived long enough, and if he did not, Rowley would inherit the title, so they both needed to be familiar with courts." Philippa added, "I intended to be in the cathedral for the Easter service, but my charrette broke a wheel and I made an overnight stop." "Well, now that you're here, let's have dinner," Caris said. They went into the dining hall. Caris opened the windows that looked on to the river. Cool, fresh air came in. She wondered what Merthyn would do about Lola. He said nothing, leaving her to stew upstairs, to Caris's relief. A brooding adolescent at the dinner table could bring down everyone's spirits. They ate mutton boiled with leeks. Merthyn poured red wine, and Philippa drank thirstily. She had become fond of wine. Perhaps it was her consolation. While they were eating, Em came in looking anxious. "There's somebody at the kitchen door to see the mistress," she said. Merthyn said impatiently, "Well, who is it?" "He wouldn't mention his name, but he said the mistress would know him." "What kind of person?" "A young man. By his clothes, a peasant, not a town dweller." Em had a snobbish dislike of villagers. "Well, he sounds harmless. Let him come in." A moment later, in walked a tall figure with a hood pulled forward to cover most of his face. When he drew it back, Caris recognized Gwenda's elder son, Sam. Caris had known him all his life. She had seen him born, had watched his slimy head emerge from the small body of his mother. She had observed him as he grew and changed and became a man. She saw Wulfric in him now, in the way he walked and stood and raised a hand slightly as he was about to speak. She had always suspected that Wulfric was not, in fact, his father, but, close as she was to Gwenda, she had never mentioned her doubt. Some questions were better left unasked. However, the suspicion had inevitably returned when she heard that Sam was wanted for the murder of John O'Reeve, for Sam, when born, had had a look of Ralph. Now he came up to Caris, lifted his hand in that gesture of Wulfric's, hesitated, then went down on one knee. "Save me, please," he said. Caris was horrified. "How can I save you?" "Hide me. I've been on the run for days. I left Old Church in the dark and walked through the night, and I've hardly rested since. Just now I tried to buy something to eat in a tavern, and someone recognized me, and I had to run. He looked so desperate that she felt a surge of compassion. Nevertheless, she said, "But you can't hide here. You're wanted for murder." "It was no murder. It was a fight. Jono struck first. He hit me with a leg iron. Look!" Sam touched his face in two places, ear and nose, to indicate two scabbed gashes. The physician in Caris could not help noting that the injuries were about 5 days old, and the nose was healing well enough, though the ear really needed a stitch. But her main thought was that Sam should not be here. "You have to face justice," she said. "They'll take Jono's side. They're sure to. I ran away from Wigley for higher wages in Althenby. Jono was trying to take me back. They'll say he was entitled to chain a runaway." "You should have thought of that before you hit him," he said accusingly. "You employed runaways at Althenby when you were prioress?" She was stung. "Runaways, yes. Killers, no. They will hang me." Caris was torn. How could she turn him away? Merthyn spoke. "There are two reasons why you can't hide here, Sam. One is that it's a crime to conceal a fugitive, and I'm not willing to put myself on the wrong side of the law for your sake, fond though I am of your mother. But the second reason is that everyone knows your mother is an old friend of Caris's, and if the Kingsbridge constables are searching for you, this is the first place they will look." "Is it?" Sam said. He was not very bright, Caris knew. His brother Davy had all the brains. Merthyn said, "You could hardly think of a worse place than this to hide." He softened. "Drink a cup of wine, and take a loaf of bread with you, and get out of town," he said more kindly. "I'll have to find Mungo Constable and report that you were here, but I can walk slowly." He poured wine into a wooden cup.
"Thank you."
"Your only hope is to go far away where you aren't known and start a new life. You're a strong boy. You'll always find work. Go to London and join a ship. And don't get into fights." Philippa said suddenly,
"I remember your mother. Gwenda?"
Sam nodded. Philippa turned to Caris.
"I met her at Casterham, when William was alive. She came to me about that girl in Wigley who had been raped by Ralph."
"Annette?"
"Yes."
Philippa turned back to Sam.
"You must be the baby she had in her arms at the time.
Your mother is a good woman. I'm sorry for her sake that you're in trouble." There was a moment of quiet. Sam drained the cup. Caris was thinking, as no doubt Philippa and Merthyn were too, about the passage of time, and how it can change an innocent, beloved baby into a man who commits murder. In the silence, they heard voices. It sounded like several men at the kitchen door. Sam looked around him like a trapped bear. One door led to the kitchen, the other outside to the front of the house. He dashed to the front door, flung it open, and ran out. Without pausing, he headed down towards the river. A moment later, M opened the door from the kitchen, and Mungo Constable came into the dining hall, with four deputies crowding behind him, all carrying wooden clubs. Merthyn pointed at the front door. He just left.
"After him, lads," said Mungo,
and they all ran through the room and out of the door. Caris stood up and hurried outside, and the others followed her. The house was built on a low, rocky bluff, only 3 or 4 feet high. The river flowed rapidly past the foot of the little cliff. To the left, Merthyn's graceful bridge spanned the water. To the right was a muddy beach. Across the river, trees were coming into leaf in the old plague graveyard. Pokey little suburban hovels had grown up like weeds either side of the cemetery. Sam could have turned left or right, and Caris saw with a feeling of despair that he had made the wrong choice. He had gone right, which led nowhere. She saw him running along the foreshore, his boots leaving big impressions in the mud. The constables were chasing him like dogs after a hare. She felt sorry for Sam, as she always felt sorry for the hare. It was nothing to do with justice, merely that he was the quarry. Seeing he had nowhere to go, he waded into the water. Mungo had stayed on the paved footpath at the front of the house, and now he turned in the opposite direction to the left and ran towards the bridge. Two of the deputies dropped their clubs, pulled off their boots, got out of their coats, and jumped into the water in their undershirts. The other two stood on the shoreline, presumably unable to swim, or perhaps unwilling to jump into the water on a cold day. The two swimmers struck out after Sam. Sam was strong, but his heavy winter coat was now sodden and dragging him down. Caris watched with horrid fascination as the deputies gained on him. There was a shout from the other direction. Mungo had reached the bridge and was running across, and he had stopped to beckon the two non-swimming deputies to follow him. They acknowledged his signal and ran after him. He continued across the bridge. Sam reached the far shore just before the swimmers caught up with him. He gained his footing and staggered through the shallows, shaking his head, water running from his clothing. He turned and saw a deputy almost on him. The man stumbled, bending forward inadvertently, and Sam swiftly kicked him in the face with a heavy, waterlogged boot. The deputy cried out and fell back. The second deputy was more cautious. He approached Sam, then stopped, still out of reach. Sam turned and ran forward, coming out of the water onto the turf of the plague graveyard. But the deputy followed him. Sam stopped again, and the deputy stopped. Sam realized he was being toyed with. He gave a roar of anger and rushed at his tormentor. The deputy ran back, but he had the river behind him. He ran into the shallows, but the water slowed him, and Sam was able to catch him. Sam grabbed the man by the shoulders, turned him, and head-butted him. On the far side of the river, Caris heard a crack as the poor man's nose broke. Sam tossed him aside, and he fell, spurting blood into the river water. Sam turned again for the shore, but Mungo was waiting for him. Now Sam was lower down the slope of the foreshore and hampered by the water. Mungo rushed at him, stopped, let him come forward, then raised his heavy wooden club. He fainted, Sam dodged, then Mungo struck, hitting Sam on the top of his head. It looked a dreadful blow, and Caris herself gasped with shock as if she had been hit. Sam roared with pain and reflexively put his hands over his head. Mungo, experienced in fighting with strong young men, hit him again with the club, this time in his unprotected ribs. Sam fell into the water. The two deputies who had run across the bridge now arrived on the scene. Both jumped on Sam, holding him down in the shallows. The two he had wounded took their revenge, kicking and punching him savagely while their colleagues held him down. When there was no fight left in him, they at last let up and dragged him out of the water. Mungo swiftly tied Sam's hands behind his back. Then the constables marched the fugitive back towards the town. "How awful," said Caris. "Poor Gwenda." Chapter 83. The town of Shiring had a carnival air during sessions of the county court. All the inns around the square were busy, their parlours crowded with men and women dressed in their best clothes, all shouting for drinks and food. The town naturally took the opportunity to hold a market, and the square itself was so closely packed with stalls that it took half an hour to move a couple of hundred yards. As well as the legitimate stallholders, there were dozens of strolling entrepreneurs, bakers with trays of buns, a busking fiddle player, maimed and blind beggars, prostitutes showing their breasts, a dancing bear, a preaching friar. Earl Ralph was one of the few people who could cross the square quickly. He rode with three knights ahead of him, and a handful of servants behind, and his entourage went through the melee like a ploughshare, turning the crowd aside by the force of their momentum and their carelessness for the safety of people in their way. They rode on up the hill to the sheriff's castle. In the courtyard they wheeled with a flourish and dismounted. The servants immediately began shouting for ostlers and porters. Ralph liked people to know he had arrived. He was tense. The son of his old enemy was about to be tried for murder. He was on the brink of the sweetest revenge imaginable, but some part of him feared it might not happen. He was so on edge that he felt slightly ashamed. He would not have wanted his knights to know how much this meant to him. He was careful to conceal, even from Alan Fernhill, how eager he was that Sam should hang. He was afraid something would go wrong at the last minute. No one knew better than he how the machinery of justice could fail. After all, he himself had escaped hanging twice. He would sit on the judge's bench during the trial, as was his right, and do his best to make sure there was no upset. He handed his reins to a groom and looked around. The castle was not a military fortification. It was more like a tavern with a courtyard, though strongly built and well guarded. The Sheriff of Shiring could live here safe from the vengeful relatives of the people he arrested. There were basement dungeons in which to keep prisoners, and guest apartments where visiting judges could stay unmolested. Sheriff Bernard showed Ralph to his room. The sheriff was the king's representative in the county, responsible for collecting taxes as well as administering justice. The post was lucrative, the salary usefully supplemented by gifts, bribes, and percentages skimmed off the top of fines and forfeited bail money. The relationship between earl and sheriff could be fractious. The earl ranked higher, but the sheriff's judicial power was independent. Bernard, a rich wool merchant of about Ralph's age, treated Ralph with an uneasy mixture of camaraderie and deference. Philippa was waiting for Ralph in the apartment set aside for them. Her long grey hair was tied up in an elaborate headdress, and she wore an expensive coat in drab shades of grey and brown. Her haughty manner had once made her a proud beauty, but now she just looked like a grumpy old woman. She might have been his mother. He greeted his sons, Jerry and Rowley. He was not sure how to deal with children, and he had never seen much of his own. As babies, they had been cared for by women, of course, and now they were at the monk's school. He addressed them somewhat as if they were squires in his service, giving them orders at one moment and joshing them in a friendly way the next. He would find them easier to talk to when they were older. It did not seem to matter. They regarded him as a hero, whatever he did. "Tomorrow you shall sit on the judge's bench in the courtroom," he said. "I want you to see how justice is done." Jerry, the elder, said, "Can we look around the market this afternoon?" "Yes. Get Dickie to go with you." Dickie was one of the Earl's castle servants. "Here, take some money to spend." He gave them each a handful of silver pennies. The boys went out. Ralph sat down across the room from Philippa. He never touched her, and tried always to keep his distance, so that it would not happen by accident. He felt sure that she dressed and acted like an old woman, to make sure he was not attracted to her. She also went to church every day. It was a strange relationship for two people who had once conceived a child together, but they had been stuck in it for years, and it would never change. At least it left him free to fondle servant girls and tumble tavern wenches. However, they had to talk about the children. Philippa had strong views, and over the years, Ralph had realized it was easier to discuss things with her rather than make unilateral decisions and then have a fight when she disagreed. Now Ralph said, "Gerald is old enough to be a squire." Philippa said, "I agree." "Good," said Ralph, surprised. He had expected an argument. "I've already spoken to David Monmouth about him," she added. That explained her willingness. She was one jump ahead. "I see," he said, playing for time. "David agrees, and suggests we send him as soon as he is 14. Jerry was only just 13. Philippa was in fact postponing Jerry's departure by almost a year. But this was not Ralph's main worry. David, Earl of Monmouth, was married to Philippa's daughter, Odila. "Being a squire is supposed to turn a boy into a man," Ralph said. "But Jerry will get too easy a ride with David. His stepsister is fond of him. She'll probably protect him. He could have it too soft." After a moment's reflection, he added, "I expect that's why you want him to go there." She did not deny it, but said, "I thought you would be glad to strengthen your alliance with the Earl of Monmouth." She had a point. David was Ralph's most important ally in the nobility. Placing Jerry in the Monmouth household would create another bond between the two earls. David might become fond of the boy. In later years, perhaps David's sons would be squires at Earl's Castle. Such family connections were priceless. "Will you undertake to make sure the boy isn't mollycoddled there?" Ralph said.
"Of course."
"Well, all right then."
"Good. I'm glad that's settled."
Philippa stood up. But Ralph was not finished. "Now what about Rowley? He could go too, so that they would be together." Philippa did not like this idea at all, Ralph could tell, but she was too clever to contradict him flatly.
"Rowley's a bit young," she said, as if thinking it over, "and he hasn't properly learned his letters yet."
"Letters aren't as important to a nobleman as learning to fight. After all, he is second in line to the earldom. If anything should happen to Jerry..."
"Which, God forbid."
"Amen.
All the same, I think he should wait until he's 14.
"I don't know. Rowley's always been a bit womanish. Sometimes he reminds me of my brother, Merthin."
He saw a flash of fear in her eyes. She was afraid of letting her baby go, he guessed. He was tempted to insist, just to torture her. But 10 was young for a squire.
"We'll see," he said noncommittally. "He'll have to be toughened up sooner or later."
"All in good time," said Philippa.
The judge, Sir Lewis Abingdon, was not a local man, but a London lawyer from the King's Court, sent on tour to try serious cases in county courts. He was a beefy type, with a pink face and a fair beard. He was also 10 years younger than Ralph. Ralph told himself he should not be surprised. He was now 44. Half his own generation had been wiped out by the plague. Nevertheless, he continued to be startled by distinguished and powerful men who were younger than he. They waited, with Jerry and Rowley, in a side chamber at the courthouse inn, while the jury assembled and the prisoners were brought down from the castle. It turned out that Sir Lewis had been at Crecy as a young squire, though Ralph did not recall him. He treated Ralph with wary courtesy. Ralph tried subtly to probe the judge and find out how tough he was. "The statute of labourers is difficult to enforce, we find," he said. "When peasants see a way to make money, they lose all respect for the law. For every runaway who is working for an illegal wage, there is an employer who is paying it," the judge said. "Exactly. The nuns of Kingsbridge Priory have never obeyed the statute. Difficult to prosecute nuns. I don't see why." Sir Lewis changed the subject. "You have a special interest in this morning's proceedings?" he asked. He had probably been told that it was unusual for Ralph to exercise his right to sit beside the judge. "The murderer is a serf of mine," Ralph admitted, "but the main reason I'm here is to give these boys a look at how justice works. One of them is likely to be the Earl when I give up the ghost. They can watch the hangings tomorrow, too. The sooner they get used to seeing men die, the better." Lewis nodded agreement. "The sons of the nobility cannot afford to be soft-hearted." They heard the clerk of the court bang his gavel, and the hubbub from the next room died down. Ralph's anxiety was not allayed. Sir Lewis's conversation had not told him much. Perhaps that in itself was revealing. It might mean he was not easily influenced. The judge opened the door and stood aside for the Earl to go first. At the near end of the room, 2 large wooden chairs were set on a dais. Next to them was a low bench. A murmur of interest arose from the crowd as Jerry and Rowley sat on the bench. The people were always fascinated to see the children who would grow into their overlords. But more than that, Ralph thought, there was a look of innocence about the 2 prepubescent boys that was strikingly out of place in a court whose business was violence, theft, and dishonesty. They looked like lambs in a pig pen. Ralph sat in one of the 2 chairs and thought of the day 22 years ago when he had stood in this very courtroom as a criminal accused of rape, a ludicrous charge to bring against a lord when the so-called victim was one of his own serfs. Philippa had been behind that malicious prosecution. Well, he had made her suffer for it. At that trial, Ralph had fought his way out of the room as soon as the jury pronounced him guilty, and then had been pardoned when he joined the King's army and went to France. Sam was not going to escape. He had no weapon, and his ankles were chained, and the French wars seemed to have petered out, so there were no more free pardons. Ralph studied Sam as the indictment was read. He had Wulfric's build, not Gwenda's. He was a tall lad, broad across the shoulders. He might have made a useful man-at-arms if he had been more nobly born. He did not really look like Wulfric, though something about the cast of his features rang a bell. Like so many accused men, he wore an expression of superficial defiance, overlaying fear. That's just how I felt, Ralph thought. Nathan Reeve was the first witness. He was the father of the dead man, but, more importantly, he testified that Sam was a serf of Earl Ralph's and had not been given leave to go to Oldchurch. He said he had sent his son Jono to follow Gwenda in the hope of tracking down the runaway. He was not likable, but his grief was clearly genuine. Ralph was pleased. It was damning testimony. Sam's mother was standing next to him, the top of her head level with her son's shoulder. Gwenda was not beautiful. Her dark eyes were set close to a beaky nose, and her forehead and chin both receded sharply, giving her the look of a determined rodent. Yet there was something strongly sexual about her, even in middle age. It was more than 20 years since Ralph had lain with her, but he remembered her as if it were yesterday. They had done it in a room at the Bell in Kingsbridge, and he had made her kneel up on the bed. He could picture it now, and the memory of her compact body excited him. She had a lot of dark hair, he recollected. Suddenly she met his eye. She held his gaze and seemed to sense what he was thinking. On that bed she had been indifferent and motionless to begin with, accepting his thrusts passively because he had coerced her. But at the end something strange had come over her, and almost against her own will she had moved in rhythm with him. She must have remembered the same thing, for an expression of shame came over her plain face, and she looked quickly away. Next to her was another young man, presumably the second son. This one was more like her, small and wiry, with a crafty look about him. He met Ralph's gaze with a stare of intense concentration, as if he was curious what went on in the mind of an earl, and thought he might find the answer in Ralph's face. But Ralph was most interested in the father. He had hated Wulfric since their fight at the Fleece Fair of 1337. He touched his broken nose reflexively. Several other men had wounded him in later years, but none had hurt his pride so badly. However, Ralph's revenge on Wulfric had been terrible. I deprived him of his birthright for a decade, Ralph thought. I lay with his wife. I gave him that scar across his cheek when he tried to stop me escaping from this very courtroom. I dragged him home when he tried to run away. And now I'm going to hang his son. Wulfric was heavier than he used to be, but he carried it well. He had a salt-and-pepper beard that did not grow over the long scar of the sword wound Ralph had given him. His face was lined and weather-beaten. Where Gwenda looked angry, Wulfric was grief-stricken. As the peasants of Oldchurch testified that Sam had killed Jono with an oak spade, Gwenda's eyes flashed defiance, whereas Wulfric's broad forehead creased in anguish. The foreman of the jury asked whether Sam had been in fear for his life. Ralph was displeased. The question implied an excuse for the killer. A thin peasant with one eye responded, "He wasn't in fear of the bailiff, no. I think he was scared of his mother, though." The crowd tittered. The foreman asked whether Jono had provoked the attack, another question that bothered Ralph by indicating sympathy for Sam. "Provoked," said the one-eyed man, "only by hitting him across the face with a leg iron, if you call that provoking." They laughed loudly. Wulfric looked bewildered. "How can people be amused?" his expression said. "When my son's life is at stake." Ralph was feeling more anxious. The foreman seemed unsound. Sam was called to testify, and Ralph noticed that the young man resembled Wulfric more when he spoke. There was a tilt of the head and a gesture of the hand that immediately brought Wulfric to mind. Sam told how he had offered to meet Jono the following morning, and Jono had responded by trying to put an iron on his leg. Ralph spoke to the judge in an undertone. "None of this makes any difference," he said with suppressed indignation. "Whether he was in fear, whether he was provoked, whether he offered to meet the following day." Sir Lewis said nothing. Ralph said, "The bare fact is that he's a runaway and he killed the man who came to fetch him." "He certainly did that," said Sir Lewis guardedly, giving Ralph no satisfaction. Ralph looked at the spectators while the jury questioned Sam. Merthyn was in the crowd with his wife. Before becoming a nun, Caris had enjoyed dressing fashionably, and after renouncing her vows, she had reverted to type. Today she wore a gown made of two contrasting fabrics, one blue and the other green, with a fur-trimmed cloak of Kingsbridge scarlet and a little round hat. Ralph remembered that Caris had been a childhood friend of Gwenda's. In fact, she had been there the day they all saw Thomas Langley kill two men-at-arms in the woods. Merthyn and Caris would be hoping, for Gwenda's sake, that Sam would be treated mercifully. "Not if I have anything to do with it," Ralph thought. Caris's successor as prioress, Mother Joan, was in court, presumably because the nunnery owned Althenby Valley, and was therefore the illegal employer of Sam. Joan ought to be in the dock with the accused, Ralph thought, but when he caught her eye she gave him an accusing glance, as if she thought the murder was his fault more than hers. The prior of Kingsbridge had not shown up. Sam was Prior Philemon's nephew, but Philemon would not want to draw attention to the fact that he was the uncle of a murderer. Philemon had once had a protective affection for his younger sister, Ralph recalled, but perhaps that had faded with the years. Sam's grandfather, the disreputable Joby, was present, a white-haired old man now, bent and toothless. Why was he here? He had been at odds with Gwenda for years, and was not likely to have much affection for his grandson. He had probably come to steal coins from people's purses while they were absorbed in the trial. Sam stood down and Sir Lewis spoke briefly. His summing up pleased Ralph. "Was Sam Wigley a runaway?" he asked. "Did Jono Reeve have the right to arrest him? And did Sam kill Jono with his spade? If the answer to all three questions is yes, then Sam is guilty of murder." Ralph was surprised and relieved. There was no nonsense about whether Sam was provoked. The judge was sound after all. "What is your verdict?" the judge asked. Ralph looked at Wulfric. The man was stricken. "This is what happens to those who defy me," Ralph thought, and he wished he could say it out loud. Wulfric caught his eye. Ralph held his gaze, trying to read Wulfric's mind. What emotion was there? Ralph saw that it was fear. Wulfric had never shown fear to Ralph before, but now he crumbled. His son was going to die, and that had weakened him fatally. A profound satisfaction filled Ralph's being as he stared into Wulfric's frightened eyes. "I have crushed you at last," he thought, "after 24 years. Finally, you're scared." The jury conferred. The foreman seemed to be arguing with the others. Ralph watched them impatiently. Surely they could not be in doubt after what the judge had said. But there was no certainty with juries. "It can't all go wrong at this stage," Ralph thought, "can it?" They seemed to come to a resolution, though he could not guess who had prevailed. The foreman stood up. "We find Sam Wigley guilty of murder," he said. Ralph kept his eyes fixed on his old enemy. Wulfric looked as if he had been stabbed. His face went pale and he closed his eyes as if in pain. Ralph tried not to smile in triumph. Sir Lewis turned to Ralph, and Ralph tore his gaze away from Wulfric. "What are your thoughts about the sentence?" said the judge. There's only one choice, as far as I'm concerned. Sir Lewis nodded. The jury has made no recommendation for mercy. They don't want a runaway to get away with murdering his bailiff.
The ultimate penalty, then?
Of course.
The judge turned back to the court. Ralph locked his gaze on Wulfric again. Everyone else looked at Sir Lewis. The judge said, Sam Wagley, you have murdered the son of your bailiff, and you are sentenced to death. You shall be hanged in Shiring Market Square tomorrow at dawn, and may God have mercy on your soul. Wulfric staggered. The younger son grabbed his father's arm and held him upright, otherwise he might have fallen to the floor.
Let him drop, Ralph wanted to say. He's finished.
Ralph looked at Gwenda. She was holding Sam's hand, but she was looking at Ralph. Her expression surprised him. He expected grief, tears, screams, hysterics. But she stared back at him steadily. There was hatred in her eyes, and something else, defiance. Unlike her husband, she did not look crushed. She did not believe the case was over. She looked, Ralph thought with dismay, as if she had something up her sleeve. Chapter 84 Carys was in tears as Sam was taken away, but Merthyn could not pretend to be grief-stricken. It was a tragedy for Gwenda, and he felt desperately sorry for Wulfric. However, it was no bad thing for the rest of the world that Sam should be hanged. John O'Reeve had been carrying out the law. It might well be a bad law, an unjust law, an oppressive law. But that did not give Sam the right to kill Jono. After all, Nate Reeve was also bereaved. The fact that nobody liked Nate made no difference. A thief was brought up before the bench, and Merthyn and Carys left the courtroom and went into the parlour of the tavern. Merthyn got some wine and poured a cup for Carys. A moment later, Gwenda came up to where they sat.
"It's noon," she said. "We have 18 hours to save Sam."
Merthyn looked up at her in surprise. "What do you propose?" he said.
"We must get Ralph to ask the king to pardon him."
That seemed highly unlikely. How would you persuade him to do that?
"I can't, obviously," Gwenda said, "but you can."
Merthyn felt trapped. He did not believe Sam deserved a pardon. On the other hand, it was hard to refuse a pleading mother. He said, "I intervened with my brother on your behalf once before. Do you remember?"
"Of course," Gwenda said, "over Wulfric not inheriting his father's land."
"He turned me down flat."
"I know," she said, "but you have to try."
"I'm not sure I'm the best person."
"Who else would he even listen to?"
That was right. Merthyn had little chance of success, but no one else had any. Carys could see that he was reluctant, and she threw her weight in on Gwenda's side.
"Please, Merthyn," she said, "think how you would feel if it was Lola."
He was about to say that girls don't get into fights. Then he realized that in Lola's case it was all too likely. He sighed.
"I think this is a doomed enterprise," he said.
He looked at Carys. "But for your sake, I'll try." Gwenda said,
"Why don't you go now?"
"Because Ralph is still in court.
It's almost dinner time. They'll be finished soon. You could wait in the private chamber."
He had to admire her resolve.
"All right," he said.
He left the parlour and walked around to the back of the tavern. A guard was standing outside the judge's private room.
"I'm the Earl's brother," Merthyn said to the sentry.
"Alderman Merthyn of Kingsbridge?"
"Yes, Alderman. I know you," the guard said. "I'm sure it will be all right for you to wait inside."
Merthyn went into the little room and sat down. He felt uncomfortable asking his brother for a favour. The two of them had not been close for decades. Ralph had long ago turned into something Merthyn did not recognise. Merthyn did not know the man who could rape Annet and murder Tilly. It seemed impossible that such a one could have grown from the boy Merthyn had called his brother. Since their parents had died, They had not met except on formal occasions, and even then they spoke little. It was presumptuous of him to use their relationship as justification for asking for a privilege. He would not have done it for Gwenda, but for Caris he had to. He did not wait long. After a few minutes, the judge and the earl came in. Merthyn noticed that his brother's limp, the result of a wound suffered in the French wars, was getting worse as he aged. Sir Lewis recognized Merthyn and shook hands. Ralph did the same and said ironically, "A visit from my brother is a rare pleasure." It was not an unfair jibe, and Merthyn acknowledged it with a nod. "On the other hand," he said, "I suppose that if anyone is entitled to plead with you for mercy, I am."
"What need do you have of mercy? Did you kill someone?"
"Not yet." Sir Lewis chuckled. Ralph said,
"What, then?"
"You and I have known Gwenda since we were all children together." Ralph nodded.
"I shot her dog with that bow you made."
Merthyn had forgotten that incident. It was an early sign of how Ralph was going to turn out, he realized with hindsight. "Perhaps you owe her mercy on that account."
"I think Nate Reeve's son is worth more than a damned dog, don't you?"
"I didn't mean to suggest otherwise, just that you might balance cruelty then with kindness now."
"Balance?"
Ralph said, with anger rising in his voice, and Merthyn knew then that his cause was lost.
"Balance?"
He tapped his broken nose.
"What should I balance against this?"
He pointed a finger aggressively at Merthyn. "I'll tell you why I won't give Sam a pardon. Because I looked at Wolfric's face in the courtroom today, as his son was declared guilty of murder, and do you know what I saw there? Fear. That insolent peasant is afraid of me, at last. He has been tamed."
"He means so much to you?"
"I'd hang 6 men to see that look." Merthyn was ready to give up. Then he thought of Gwenda's grief, and he tried once more. "If you've conquered him, your work is done, isn't it?" he argued. "So let the boy go. Ask the king for a pardon."
"No, I want to keep Wolfric the way he is."
Merthyn wished he had not come. Putting pressure on Ralph only brought out the worst in him. Merthyn was appalled by his vengefulness and malice. He never wanted to speak to his brother again. The feeling was familiar. He had been through this with Ralph before. Somehow it always came as a shock to be reminded of what he was really like. Merthyn turned away. "Well, I had to try," he said. "Goodbye." Ralph became cheery.
"Come up to the castle for dinner," he said. "The sheriff lays a good table. Bring Caris. We'll have a real talk. Philippa's with me. You like her, don't you?"
Merthyn had no intention of going. "Let me speak to Caris," he said. Caris would rather have dinner with Lucifer, he knew.
"I may see you later, then."
Merthyn made his escape. He returned to the parlor. Caris and Gwenda looked expectantly at him as he crossed the room. He shook his head. "I did my best," he said. "I'm sorry." Gwenda had expected this. She was disappointed, but not surprised. She had felt she had to try through Merthyn. The other remedy she had at her disposal was so much more drastic. She thanked Merthyn perfunctorily and left the inn, heading for the castle on the hill. Wolfric and Davy had gone to a cheap tavern in the suburbs where they could get a filling dinner for a farthing. Wolfric was no good at this sort of thing anyway. His strength and honesty were useless in negotiations with Ralph and his kind. Besides, Wolfric could not be allowed even to know about how she hoped to persuade Ralph. As she was walking up the hill, she heard horses behind her. She stopped and turned. It was Ralph and his entourage with the judge. She stood still and looked hard at Ralph, making sure he caught her eye as he passed. He would guess she was coming to see him. A few minutes later, she entered the courtyard of the castle, but access to the sheriff's house was barred. She made her way to the porch of the main building and spoke to the marshal of the hall.
"My name is Gwenda from Wigley," she said.
Please tell Earl Ralph I need to see him in private.
Yes, yes, said the Marshal. Look around you. All these people need to see the Earl, the judge, or the sheriff.
There were 20 or 30 people standing around the courtyard, some clutching rolls of parchment. Gwenda was prepared to take a terrible risk to save her son from hanging, but she would not get the opportunity unless she succeeded in speaking to Ralph before dawn. How much? She said to the Marshal. He looked at her with a little less disrespect.
I can't promise he'll see you.
You can give him my name. 2 shillings, 24 silver pennies. It was a lot of money, but Gwenda had all their savings in her purse. However, she was not yet ready to hand over the money. What is my name? She said.
I don't know.
I just told you. How can you give Earl Ralph my name if you can't remember it? He shrugged. Tell me again. Gwenda, from Wigley.
All right. I'll mention it to him.
Gwenda slipped her hand into her purse, brought out a handful of little silver coins, and counted 24. It was 4 weeks' wages for a labourer. She thought of the back-breaking work she had done to earn the money. Now this idle, supercilious doorkeeper was going to get it for doing next to nothing. The Marshal held out his hand. She said, What's my name?
Gwenda.
Gwenda from where?
Wigley.
He added, That's where this morning's murderer came from, isn't it? She gave him the money. The Earl will want to see me, she said as forcefully as she could. The Marshal pocketed the coins. Gwenda retreated into the courtyard, not knowing whether she had wasted her money. A moment later she saw a familiar figure with a small head on wide shoulders, Alan Fernhill. That was a piece of luck. He was crossing from the stables to the hall. The other petitioners did not recognize him. Gwenda stood in his way.
Hello, Alan, she said.
It's Sir Alan now.
Congratulations. Will you tell Ralph that I want to see him?
I don't need to ask you what it's about.
Say I want to meet him in private.
Alan raised an eyebrow. No offense, but you were a girl last time. You're 20 years older today.
Do you think perhaps we should let him decide?
Of course. He grinned insultingly. I know he remembers that afternoon at the Bell.
Alan had been there, of course. He had watched Gwenda take off her dress and stared at her naked body. He had seen her walk to the bed and kneel on the mattress, facing away. He had laughed coarsely when Ralph said she was better looking from behind. She hid her revulsion and shame.
I was hoping he would remember,
she said as neutrally as she could. The other petitioners realized Alan must be someone important. They began to crowd around, speaking to him, begging and pleading. He pushed them aside and went into the hall. Gwenda settled down to wait. After an hour, it was clear Ralph was not going to see her before dinner. She found a patch of ground that was not too muddy and sat with her back to a stone wall, but she never took her eyes off the entrance to the hall. A second hour passed, and a third. Noblemen's dinners often went on all afternoon. Gwenda wondered how they could keep on eating and drinking for such a long time. Why did they not burst? She had eaten nothing all day, but she was too tense to feel hungry. It was grey April weather, and the sky began to darken early. Gwenda shivered on the cold ground, but she stayed where she was. This was her only chance. Servants came out and lit torches around the courtyard. Lights appeared behind the shutters in some of the windows. Night fell, and Gwenda realized there were about 12 hours left until dawn. She thought of Sam, sitting on the floor in one of the underground chambers beneath the castle, and wondered if he was cold. She fought back tears. It's not over yet, she told herself, but her courage was weakening. A tall figure blocked the light from the nearest torch. She looked up to see Alan. Her heart leaped. Come with me, he said. She jumped to her feet and moved towards the hall door. Not that way. She looked inquiringly at him. You said privately, didn't you? Alan said. He's not going to see you in the chamber he shares with the Countess. Come this way.
She followed him through a small door near the stables. He led her through several rooms and up a staircase. He opened a door to a narrow bedchamber. She stepped inside. Alan did not follow her in, but closed the door from the outside.